Thank you very much for now.
Now I'd like to introduce Eben Moghlen, legal counsel for the Free Software Foundation and a board member, and of course, the lead of the Software Freedom Law Center.
Thanks, Peter. I'll be a little quick and make up the lost time so that we won't lose the question period. Let me start by pointing out the irony of the situation. It's been a while since we've seen many of you, and so to think of the GPL3 process as one which is thankfully almost over may not conform to your understanding of the situation quite as much as it conforms to ours. Richard has told you that there will be another draft out on Wednesday. That will be denominated a third discussion draft so as to allow for additional public conversation about the draft. It's been a long time since we've been out in public. We will use that renewed public discussion period to check with those members of the community who haven't participated in a while and see how they feel about the license draft, suggest improvements, etc. We will move from there briskly into a last call draft period, and I hope we will be all wrapped up by early June. That still leaves, for Richard, for me, and for you, a fair amount of GPL3 license time. But I want to talk about what happens after that. Because, at least for those of us who've been living with the license every day, it is, thankfully, nearly over. And there's lots of planning to do about the world after GPL3. So, allowing for the fact that I'm sure you're all going to have lots of questions about the license, and we'll talk about them in the question period, I want to look a little bit over the horizon past the license itself and towards the next phases of our work. I think we have, in a number of different respects, moved from one period of the history of free software into another this year while the license was being constructed. And not because of the license, but without regard to the license. For one thing, I think it would be important to say, I think the Microsoft Novell deal represents not primarily a business deal between Novell and Microsoft, not primarily a change in our relation to one distribution company, but two much larger changes. Both of them, I think, critical to us. In the first place, I think it's important to understand that there is now a very substantial challenge to the commercial distribution system as we have seen it grown up over the last several years. Because there aren't press here, and because, therefore, what we get to say doesn't travel quite as widely as it might under other circumstances, I'm going to be a little blunter here than I would be elsewhere in public. The survival of the Red Hat Novell distribution system is now at stake. Outside in the world where stock values are calculated every day, I might put that a little bit more lightly, but let me say it here the way I actually think it exists. The problem is fundamentally this one. The largest of the IT vendors, Hewlett-Packard and IBM, most importantly, decided some years ago that it was a good idea to have other people commercially distribute free software, where other people meant smaller companies with shallower pockets. That would help them, the largest of the vendors, to speed free software's way into the market without themselves having to take all the legal risk of doing the distribution themselves. IBM and, to a lesser extent, Hewlett-Packard were original investors involved in the creation of Red Hat and involved in the repurposing of Novell from a proprietary software company making and selling netware to a largely non-proprietary company distributing versions of free software for commercial enterprise use. The basic understanding upon which those businesses were based was the assumption that they would have service-oriented business models, that they would make up for the difficulty of selling the software at super competitive prices by offering enterprise-level service to enterprise customers. The difficulty is that within the last couple of years, the large vendors themselves have decided to compete for that service business. And so Red Hat and Novell now compete against IBM and Hewlett-Packard for the service business that was supposed to be the profit that would allow them to distribute free software to enterprises in a profitable way. As a result, there is substantial economic pressure on the operations of those companies. In Red Hat's case, for reasons which I think are idiosyncratic to Red Hat, that has rather little effect on Red Hat's stock value. It has been very punishing to Novell management. And if you want to think about the prehistory of Novell and Microsoft's business deal, you might want to think of that prehistory as the enhanced competitive environment faced by Red Hat and Novell as a result of competition, direct competition from IBM and Hewlett-Packard. How that organizational process works itself out may seem initially to be only a subject of interest to those who buy and sell stock or who buy and sell the software of wealthy companies. But as pressure heats up in that part of the industrial stack, there is a danger that red-hot metal will rain down on the part of the ecosystem where we all live and work. And part of my job as a lawyer trying to take care of free software projects is now the work of trying to figure out what will happen under various scenarios of competition and potential failure in that layer which distributes free software to enterprise. There are upside outcomes as well as downside outcomes, but we are moving closer to all of them because another tipping point in the history of the industry looms in the near future. And so we're going to see more changes, and those changes are going to be complicated ones that are going to present difficult threats and challenges as well as some opportunities to us. And we're going to need to be agile and aware of our surroundings. It's not going to be simple for the next 2 years. There are games or parts of games or scenarios of trouble that we have half played out in our minds over the last 5 years, which are now much more relevant than they were before. Another major thing which I think has happened this year, and it is very largely as a consequence of good decisions made by the free world and bad decisions made in Redmond, is that the breaking point of DRM is, I think, nearly upon us. We are now moving very close to what, by the middle of this year, I think will be a pretty powerful distinction on a clear point of issue. Microsoft and Apple together have decided to maximize DRM and maximize closedness. Mr. Jobs has decided to bet everything on the idea that if you have a neat, attractive, wonderful, totally cool phone that you can't change at all and that is totally locked up in the interests of everybody but you, that that will be fine. And Mr. Gates has bet the farm on the idea that an operating system filled with tilt pins and self-destruct buttons, where a 12-year-old hacker in Australia figures out a way to make a display work according to his will instead of other people's will, suddenly results in all the displays all over the world that other people have bought and installed ceasing to operate, that kind of an operating system is a saleable property. Already government agencies have begun holding that they can't afford to have that kind of software lying around. Already there are problems. The National Institute of Standards and Technology, playing its bleeding edge role in the federal government, has decided that Vista is too insecure for real use. There are rumors of a consolidated federal security position that would prevent Vista apps from being bought by the United States government unless they meet non-tilt pin, non-self-destruct, no possibility of, you know, peripheral failure regulations. We are moving towards a world in which by the middle of this year, their new products will have been fully identified with total lockdown, and we will be offering a GPL that says no DRM in consumer devices, and we will be offering that GPL not just with the passionate endorsement of the free software movement, but with the blessing of the major IT vendors and manufacturers whom we have over this year split off from the entertainment industry for the first time. The consequence will, I think, be a much clearer politics. Are you for it or against it? If you're for locking everybody up and using technology as a jail, there's technology for you from Redmond and from Apple. If you're for freedom and you're for not locking everything up, then there is clearly technology for you and you want to buy under GPL. That's a powerful new fact in the world, I think. We've reached a tipping point of great importance, I believe, on the patent question, too, although you had to be using a super magnifying glass to see it happen. Richard presented to you the traditional theoretical analysis of the situation about patent law and us. You can't cure malaria by killing mosquitoes. You have to drain the swamp. We've got to get software out of the patent system. That's the only way to solve the problem. For 10 years now, although we have said that and pointed at it, and we have increasingly converted stalwarts in the IT industry to that position, there was no likelihood of any legislative move to remove software from the patent system because pharmaceuticals did not want IT to go. Big Pharma is essentially the owner of the global patent system. It exists for Big Pharma's convenience. But the presence of the IT industries in the patent system has been good for Big Pharma because it has given the world the impression that the patent system was not just the subsidy for one industry, that it was in general a guarantor of innovation in the high-tech fields. The crucial question in all attempts to make significant reform in the patent system to get IT out over the past decade has been, how could you do it when pharma owned the US Congress? And it was pretty much as simple as that. Even the largest and most influential of the IT firms, with strong government relations departments, lots of skill in lobbying, and an increasing concern for the harm done by the patent system to their interests, even those firms have repeatedly said to us, there's just nothing we can do. Pharma has its foot solidly jammed on the brake, and there's no way out. Until they let go, there won't be any change. This year, there's a case in the United States Supreme Court which raises a peripheral issue concerning patentability of software. It's a lawsuit between the two giants, Microsoft and AT&T. And the question that it raises in the minds of the Supreme Court justices is, does it constitute exportation of an infringing patent, of goods, software goods infringing a patent, when Microsoft mails gold master CDs to Europe to be there duplicated to produce products to be sold in Europe? In theory, this is a question of the interpretation of a subsidiary portion of the patent statute, which deals with the question of what constitutes a good being exported. With my partner, Mr. Ravisher, whom Richard mentioned at the Software Freedom Law Center, we filed a brief in the United States Supreme Court saying, as we have done many a time before, well, actually, justices, there's a simpler way out of this. You should just hold that software is not within patent scope at all. You don't have to get to these other issues because the real fact is you should interpret the patent law the way you traditionally interpreted the patent law, which if you do, you'll find software outside patent scope altogether, and that'll be the end of this problem. It wasn't any surprise at all to us that we filed that brief. And it wasn't any surprise to the press that we filed that brief. And we got beaten up by some of the pro-patent stalwarts for saying anything as disgraceful as that. Greg Aharonian on his mailing list announced that I had lied to the Supreme Court and should be disbarred for presenting this theory. What was the real surprise was that our brief was almost word for word and idea for idea the same as a brief filed in the Supreme Court by the Eli Lilly Company, saying, Software's out of patent scope. You should stop thinking of software as inside patent scope. Let them out. That's the first time in the history of patent law that a major pharmaceuticals company has taken the position that they would be better off with IT out of the system. And it's a historical measurement of the beginning of the pressure that results from the fact that when IBM and Hewlett-Packard and all the other majors, with including some days Microsoft, have all decided that the patent system is dangerously misapplied to software, pharma would be better off pushing them out of the tent than trying forcibly to keep them in. I wouldn't want to say how long it's going to take, but I would say now it's just a matter of time. Because pharma now understands, within that bulk that owns the United States Congress, that there are two sides to this question and that the time may have come to let software go. Which brings us far closer to the possibility of getting the kind of systemic change that Richard has been talking about for a decade than we have been for that decade while he's been talking about it. So, if you think about those pieces as the beginnings of elements of a major shift in the way we relate to a series of our contemporaries elsewhere, I think you can begin to generalize to what the overall political change really is. We've spent a long period of time contending for the reality of the Free Software Commons, trying to prove first to other developers, then to industry parties, then to large users, and then finally to individual users behind their desktops or their laptops, that free software existed, could be usable by them, could produce money for the people who sold and distributed and modified it, and would in the end be not just morally more satisfying to them, but also practically engage with their needs and concerns. I think that process, the process of convincing people that the commons exists, is now basically completed. We're here to stay. Everybody understands that. Even Microsoft, I think, now finally recognizes that the extirpation of the free software idea is impossible, and the rest of the industry believes that it is no longer desirable to attempt to return to a state in which everything is owned by somebody and there is no commons. This is probably not just a phenomenon in software. I think in other areas of technology and culture, the commons is also considered to be here to stay. I do not think that even the commercial broadcasters think that YouTube can be eliminated. It is perfectly clear that the music industry sits right now on the verge of deciding to obliterate the preceding generation's business models and to start over with music that is not controlled or locked down. The movie companies, to be sure, do not accept the permanence of the video commons yet, but they will get there. Everybody is marching in a line towards a recognition that commons is here, that forms of unowned production are valuable and indeed inevitable in the global economy. Now the fundamental issues are becoming, how does the commons sector of the economy relate to the market sectors of the economy? What are the mechanisms of that relationship? And the market sectors in the economy basically have a theoretical answer to that question. That theoretical answer is, we can control commons. We can build mechanisms for making commons do our work instead of the work identified by the creators of commons as what they wanted to have. These mechanisms for controlling commons go generally under the name of technology platforms, stickinesses, mechanisms for confining the dynamics of commons to a pro-ownership result. Microsoft Windows, the iPhone, right? The alternation between copyleft licenses and permissive licenses, In the corners of this world where I travel, the most frequent complaint launched against IBM by its competitors in the industry is, IBM loves the GPL for everybody else and the Apache license for itself. Right? That's a technology platform built out of licensing. It's, you know, it's Velcro, stickiness in one direction, loops on the other, right? There are a whole series of mechanisms that people identify to hold the commons within some confinement vessel that makes it work for them, that delegitimizes its politics, as Richard would say, that causes the principles to be forgotten, that deconcentrates attention on morality, but also that changes practical results in the interest of particular forms of controllability on the output side, particular ways of manipulating the situation. The iPhone is a technology platform for the idea of the thin client as destructive of the telephony oligopoly without actually opening communication up to users. An attempt to do for telecoms what the iPod tried to do for music. Please note that by the middle of this year, Mr. Jobs will be trying to build an iPhone which must not have any GPL3 software in it, because GPL3 will come with anti-DRM rules that would preclude the construction of the iPhone. We are about to watch as Mr. Jobs, in other words, tries to build a new platform for constraining commons, which is for the first time prohibited by GPL instead of facilitated by GPL. This is going to be an inspiring experience. And I promise you, it isn't going to be a quiet one. Whatever happens, Mr. Jobs is involved, right? So for those who feel that there isn't enough publicity and noise, got you covered. Okay. Where we are going, in other words, is into the thick of a series of relationships between global business, which now knows how it wants to divert our course towards its profit, and our unquestioned influence as parties without whom you can't do. The world of the telephony meltdown is going to be based around the question, is Nokia going to be as open as Apple is closed? The world of the laptop by late this year is going to be, has Mr. Dell given in to his customers and decided to sell free software inside preloaded? In which case all the other major laptop manufacturers will have had to go too, and HP will have made its choice, and the Chinese ThinkPad company will have made its choice as well. Or can Mr. Gates keep the laptop as territory within which no manufacturer embeds us? Which platform is the laptop will be the question by mid-year. And with that question comes a whole lot of news for the entertainment companies and the video companies and everybody else, because that's the biggest screen we possess. And that's the media PC and the set-top box and everything that comes along behind. There's an odd theory out there in the world these days. The hardware business is a very strange business right now. If you think about it, there's lots of people making absolutely no money in the hardware business, no matter how much hardware they sell. And there's lots of people losing money on every piece of hardware they sell, lots and lots of money. We only said that there was zero marginal cost in software, right? We never said that there was zero marginal cost in shoes and tables and real estate. When people said to us, why, this is just mere communist anarchism, we said, no. We're drawing a careful theoretical distinction between software, which can be copied endlessly at the push of a button, and real hardware stuff with non-zero, not marginal cost. But the hardware manufacturers have caught the bug. And all of a sudden, they have theories that we would never have endorsed about why it's a good idea to lose hundreds of dollars a unit on tabletop supercomputers in order to lock them down and sell games to the people who buy them. A very strange development in the economics of the computer industry, you've got to admit, right? Imagine if IBM, in the high days of the mainframe, had decided to lose $100,000 per mainframe as a marketing strategy, right?
Actually, that's not completely impossible.
No, it was possible in those days. It was possible in those days, but they wouldn't have done it. You could have done it. I'm not suggesting it couldn't have been done.
So, Dr. Moglen, why don't you then talk about the implications of the razors and blades paradigm for freedom?
Sure, and that's exactly where I want to go. So take a look at the TiVo problem, the one we went out to solve this year if it meant naming a name. It took a long time for TiVo's lawyers to get their stuff together to call because Richard had been slanging away at them in public for months and they hadn't said anything back, and I kept waiting. And eventually we got a call. And I said, you know, if it had been up to me, guys, I probably wouldn't have made you the poster child. And if you go back over my statements, I tended to go light on that TiVoization stuff. Because you have a history of cooperative dealing with us, and I always thought that the basic deal was if people cooperated with us over GPL3 questions, we didn't put their pictures in the newspaper. Well, they said, if you really feel as bad as all that, then what you can do is change the license so it doesn't cover us. Not so fast, I said. Okay, they said, we have a concession to offer. We'll stop encrypting the movies on the hard drive if you'll let us out from this license stuff. And I said, gee, I'm really sorry to have to tell you this, but that's totally irrelevant. You're still under the mistaken impression that my client is the Free Movie Foundation. We may not like digital restrictions applied to movies, but that's not the problem we're dealing with here, and that's not the problem we're trying to solve in this license. We're the Free Software Foundation, and our concern is with the freedom to change the software in your product. If you give us the freedom to change the software in the product, we're done. Oh no, he said, we could never do that because we only make our money on the subscription to the TV Guide. And if users could change the software in the box, nobody would buy our TV Guide. Oh, come on, I said. Maybe Andrew Tridgell won't buy your TV Guide. But Aunt Sally is always going to buy your TV Guide. It's no big deal. Oh, no, he said. You don't understand. We lose money on every single one of those boxes. We can't afford to let anybody not subscribe to the TV Guide. You know, I said, I think this may be your problem. This business model of selling hardware at hundreds of dollars of cost per loss per unit, this is a job you should leave to people who have more money to lose. Like Microsoft and Sony. You're going to have to raise the price of the box. Oh, no, we can't do that. Why not? Because if we do that, we're going to get our lunch eaten by Myth TV. Well, you see how it is. The business model comes to depend upon anti-freedom, because if they take our software for nothing, and they take their freedom away, and you take your freedom away for you for nothing, then putting those two subsidies together, they can continue to sell hardware at a loss to someone else. By giving up your freedom and permitting lockdown, you're allowing them to sell a little bit more below-cost hardware to other people, which is not a good deal. Not a good deal for us, and not in the end a good deal for razor blade sellers whose handles are too expensive for them to support out of their own earnings.
But Mr. Moglen, you're confusing. Because
that was inevitable, I think.
Because as far as I can tell, having working digital restrictions management is not exclusive with the right to change the software.
I'm not sure I understand what that was supposed to mean, Bruce. Help me more.
Okay, this is what I am currently thrashing around trying to figure out what you have said in legal language versus the goal of eliminating DRM that you were espousing today. What you have said in legal language is that the DRM must not lock down or break the software, and that the functionality of playing the video must continue.
And so?
And so, that does not mean, as far as I can tell from the legal language that you have written, that does not mean that there must be no DRM that restricts movies. What it means is there must be no DRM that restricts software.
Well, that's all you would expect the software license to be concerned about directly. But the indirect consequences of what we're about to do will bring all of it to an end. It's not going to happen as a consequence of some incantation in the license. That's irrelevant. The license is only going to deal with some GPL software, which is some small part of all the software that gets used to make all these artifacts. The license isn't directly going to do everything all by itself. Remember, I said there's a tipping point approach. The question is, where can you add just enough energy in the right direction to change the trajectory of the system as a whole? And what's about to happen is the system is about to inflect as a whole. And that's not happening only because of GPL3. It's happening because the music industry has reached the point at which non-reform is impossible, which means that half the coalition to lock down everything on Earth in the interest of content is about to defect. That will leave the video mongers with their only army in the field being their own army. That's like the moment where pharma realizes that IT is no longer going to subsidize a maximalist patent system by providing political cover to them. The MPAA all by itself is not going to be able to control all the technology on Earth. The fact that RIAA was rated the worst company in the world this year is a sign of what MPAA's future would be if it went down that road, and it isn't going to go there. In particular, it isn't going to go there if Intel and IBM and Hewlett-Packard and Nokia and Motorola and all the other vendors in the IT industry have decided to sell out the entertainment industry view of trusted or treacherous computing, which locks every computer to their substrate of no movie must leak. That's not going to happen. With the publication of GPL3, they're going to see that alternate coalition building is now the order of the day, that they can no longer count upon having a coalition stronger and broader than the other fellows. It's the fulfillment of what we started to do over the SSSCA-CBDTA in 2001 and early 2002, when we tried to say we could build a bigger, broader tent than the movie industry. The collapse of that legislation, which I was altogether in favor of, right? I shed no tears over its demise. But the collapse of that legislation terminated the broader coalition building exercise on which we were then engaged. We have recycled much of that work, and we have more to do now. The movie industry is going to find itself, as pharma is finding itself, a little too isolated. And that's going to make some major changes in what happens. There are costs to pay for that. There's no question about it. We have coalitions, and coalitions are burdensome things. We have to meet the needs of lots of different people inside that coalition. But the tide will turn on DRM this year. If I am standing here next year and it hasn't turned, you'll know what to throw at me. Okay?
DVDs?
As you like. You'll figure it out for yourselves. This is the moment where the politics begins to change. And it changes not only because of what we do, but it changes partially because of what we do. And if you can convince the kernel developers to move to GPL3, that will push the thing way further along. Right? That will push the thing way further along. All right, so I say then that we're going to be living in a world after GPL3 in which we have a number of political processes going on fundamentally favorable to us and a lot of opportunity for coalition building. We also have to do some heavy lifting. The Microsoft patent offensive that begins with MS Novell will continue no matter what we do about this particular deal. I said to you at the beginning of SCO that we had to win SCO not just enough to keep SCO from ever coming back. We had to win SCO enough to keep Microsoft from ever making another one. And despite all the reasons to feel troubled about the slowness and the expensiveness of IBM's response to SCO, IBM saw that need as clearly as we did. And they have responded to the SCO lawsuit in a way which makes it unpractical for Microsoft to make more SCOs. There will not be another copyright attack on the provenance and integrity of the free software big marquee programs instigated by or funded by Microsoft. The SCO experience doesn't cause them to want to do it again. They didn't get enough disruption, and they spent far too much money for the disruption they didn't get. The same has to be true about making deals like MS Novell, which is why the part of what interests me about our response to that deal is the part you will be reading on Wednesday, which attempts to turn the Microsoft side of the Novell deal into patent defenses for our developers. To hack the deal so that everything they have done has the reverse of its intended effect. So that every patent which they have attempted to save for purposes of aggression becomes a patent we are protected against if they try to sue on it. That's only part of the necessary response to the real onset of the Microsoft patent campaign, which MS Novell was. We should not be fooled. That was actually the beginning of the long intended campaign. We now have responses that we have to make. We will respond not only by defending against that particular deal, but by taking some strategic measures of our own against the Microsoft patent portfolio. Richard tells you, and rightly, that you can't cure malaria by slapping individual mosquitoes. But the metaphor gives you the impression that all mosquitoes are essentially equal. They either carry the malaria, single-cell protozoan, or they don't. Right? And so you slap one and you either killed one carrying the disease or you didn't, but that's all the distinction you can make. It's not quite true about patents, right? They differentiate themselves qualitatively far more effectively than mosquitoes do. If you look at anybody's patent portfolio, you will see that there are some patents which are totally unimportant. They could never be enforced. It doesn't matter whether they exist. There are other patents which are terribly important, even if they are of doubtful validity, because they control turf, which it is crucial to have free. Nobody has ever planned a careful, thoughtful, strategically designed attack on another company's patent portfolio. Because companies that get patents don't attack other people's patents. War is not carried on between patent holders by attacks on one another's real estate. The theory has always been that that leads to races to the bottom. I pull your sweater, you pull mine, and pretty soon nobody has any sweater at all. So I ask you to consider just for a moment the possibility that we might do a thing which has never been done before. that we might actually make some significant attempts to reorganize Microsoft's patent portfolio for them. One would not do that without a good deal of preparation. One would not do that without a lot of thinking. One would not do that without doing it globally across a pretty broad reach. And one would do it only with a recognition that it would stimulate an inevitable counterattack for which one has to be ready. But we are getting closer to the moment at which, for the first time, that makes sense. They have begun the war. They must run their trains. Their trains must have ball bearings. It is time to think about the factories that make the ball bearings that run the trains that allow them to have a war. So a number of things are going to happen after GPL-3 in that world. Richard pointed in his talk to the activities of the Public Patent Foundation. When we made the Software Freedom Law Center, Daniel and I were compelled to build a very thick and very high Chinese wall between the Software Freedom Law Center and the Public Patent Foundation. Because the IT firms that donate money to the Software Freedom Law Center so that we can give free legal services to hackers did not want to pay for the destruction of patent real estate. They were nervous about that. Whatever we do, we don't want our money used to destroy other people's patents. Keep it away from PubPat. Sure, we said, that's no problem. They're two completely different organizations, two sets of books, and et cetera. But I will tell you that from the moment that we made that decision, they began to subvert their own Chinese wall. Because everybody knows that there's at least one patent out there they'd really love to get rid of. And they don't want to have their fingerprints on the weapon. And so the lengths that they will go to keep their fingerprints off the weapon and to deal with the disrespectable parties who are prepared to do the dirty work in the patent system is really somewhat impressive. Right? I had a call early in the morning one morning from a lawyer for a large company with a short name, and he says, good morning. He's plainly calling from the car. He says, good morning. I have that telephone number you were asking me for, and he reads a 7-digit number into the telephone and hangs up. And I think, gee, that's interesting. I wasn't looking for a telephone. So I look at that number again, and I think to myself, it's not a telephone number. And I pull the patent. I say, oh, yes, that's a piece of skullduggery needing somebody to do something about it. And off we go, acting in conscious parallel with a company that doesn't want its name attached to this and which would deny hotly that it ever made such a phone call. It came from some lawyer's cell phone in the morning in the car on his way to work. We don't know anything about it. Right? We will do more of that work, too, because there are lots of restive people who need stuff done. We went after a patent belonging to Blackboard.com this year because it was threatening higher education software like the software in use at MIT and elsewhere. We had quite a lot of implicit support for that activity from the firms that fund SFLC. We didn't bring that re-exam through PubPat. We did that at SFLC, and nobody complained. So there's going to be a lot more proactivity in the world of patent legal defense. Another piece of where I think we are undoubtedly going to wind up going in this next year is towards some further consideration of what the software as a service without distribution of software means. What does it mean for a party to make extensive changes to free software programs and give none of them back because we're not distributing the software, we're only providing services with it? This is an area in which there is broad philosophical disagreement, even among the people in this room whom I know and respect for their thought on the subject. This is a potentially significant source of controversy within the movement in years to come. And I think it's important for us to begin to have that conversation in a thoughtful way. Merely having that conversation will be good for the attention it will get in certain places where more giving back ought to go on than is going on right now. You'll have a good effect just by mumbling about the issue on certain parties out there. If you do more searches in their search box for Afero GPL, That might be enough all by itself if the search box traffic for a Faro GPL suddenly spiked by two orders of magnitude. That might not be such a bad thing. But there's more that we can do and more that we will be doing, because it's a critical question. Not that we have an answer or that we have a sign, but it's a question we need to think about together. There are parts of the world where respect for GPL is not as high as it is in the United States. There are places where there are people doing lots of things that don't comply with GPL, and they don't think they're going to get caught, and they don't feel much inclination to obey right now. And we're going to have to go and clean up some places where there are people who aren't obeying the rules. Bangalore comes to mind. It's one of the reasons why the Software Freedom Law Center is opening an office in New Delhi this coming year, because we are going to take GPL enforcement into places where it needs to go, where it maybe hasn't been going on as firmly as it needs to. We're a global part of a global software industry now. We're crucial to the way it works. I don't think we're in any danger of not getting heard. I don't think we're in any danger of not getting heard at all. You have to be bigger than about $100 billion a year now before your CEO doesn't return our phone calls. We don't look in the world of those businesses like a small team anymore. There's lots you can say about what we look like. There's lots you can say about the difference between the t-shirt and the suit. There's lots you can say about the difference between the way we think and the way we plan, and the time scale on which we operate, and the way those businesses operate. I live pretty much at that interface, right? Hackers on the one side and the big businesses on the other. And I cross that boundary every working day, 8 or 10 or 12 or 14 times, as the phone rings or I make a call. But I don't have any sense that we're not heard, that we're not listened to, that we're not reckoned with. If anything, the concern on the other side is we're still not reliable enough. We're still not consistent enough, which is why it is not Richard Stallman who poses the biggest problem to them. They know how to understand what Richard's going to say and think and do, because they understand that he's motivated by principle, and they know that those principles are calculable. There are other parts of our community which are far less predictable than that, far less disciplined, far less principle-driven, far harder for a business to understand. And there's the constant difference of timescale. Capitalism in the United States ruinously forces businessmen to think short. A quarter, 6 months at the outside. Long-term planning is 2 years, a product cycle. Our thought processes barely begin operating until 2 years. 5, 10, 50, or 100 are the preferential Stallman timescales. We have been the parties who thought long about software, and we have been right so often that they understand now that we are likely to be right again soon. Our problem isn't that we're not going to be heard. Our problem isn't that we don't know in general what we want. We have problems about deciding in specific what our policies are. That's the normal problem called politics. That's where you come in. We make policy in a participatory way. We have to ask ourselves what we think in order to find out. There's no hierarchy sending the news down. It comes up from underneath. And our problem isn't that we can't figure out what we ought to do. The question we have is, can we execute? Can we execute our plans in a world where the other fellow has $50 billion and we have a few million? A few million a year is way more than we used to have. We are exceedingly lucky that we have learned how to tap those immense profit flows, which are now part of the world of commercial free software, in order to get the kinds of resources that we need to do some of the work. We've made enormous progress in that regard. But we are still people using just the crumbs that fall off the table in order to protect all their right to a free meal down the line. And for all that they should be saying to us, can we please write you a larger check? Please keep those geese laying golden eggs for us. They still want to get their golden eggs as cheaply as possible. Can we give just a little less and get just as many golden eggs as we had before? We are still in the business of getting them to recognize that they are the most profitable beneficiaries of what we all did for reasons that had little to do with profit in the first place. We're going to need those resources, though. This is still not a safe place for us. Richard has given, again, the reasons why, with long-term private statutory monopolies lying around, we're never completely safe in what we do. And if the Wintel conspiracy is basically over, the Disney, Apple, Microsoft axis has not gotten weaker yet. I think this is the time, as I have said, but we have to win. We're not going to get it by default. So those are what I think the issues are going to be after GPL. I think the new license is going to be immensely helpful. I think, notwithstanding Brother Perrin's obvious and well-thought-out objections, that GPL3 will help on that subject, help definitively. I think progress we have made on understanding what the patent holders can do to help and how much help we are going to get from the patent holders in GPL3 to reduce somewhat the patent threat to our software is very positive. I think we have assured for ourselves, because of the internationalization activity, at least 10 years in which the courts around the world are going to see our license respectfully and are not going to engage in acts of legal nationalism at our expense. So I think in many ways the license is helpful in this project. But I think it's really, really important as we go through the next several weeks and finish it up not to confuse the license with the mission. It's just one of the tools. And while this is a very good time, it's not a time in which finishing the license is now we can go on summer vacation. Not like that at all. Thank you very much.